I thought they were going to do the same thing. They're like, nah, we see so many handguns. It's like it's
Texas.
it's like regular stuff.
Oh, I know. Yeah, you leave California.
Nobody cared.
Exactly.
Welcome to the long-awaited episode 9 of the Frugal Firearms Podcast, a podcast designed to help you get the most for your money in all the shooting sports industries. I'm here again, this time in studio, with my co-host Ken. Ken, say hello to our listeners.
Hello, listeners. I appreciate you guys dialing in and listening in to hear us talk a little bit about trying to get the most value for your dollar in the shooting sports.
So why the heck did we spend so much time not recording? I mean, it's been the better part of a year, honestly.
There has been a lot going on in both our lives.
Yeah, so. For both of us. I don't think I've necessarily mentioned it before, but I work for the Navy, and needs of the Navy, I'm not in the Navy, but I work for the Navy, and when they say needs of the Navy, it means something, and you end up just being busier than you want to be. And,
absolutely.
And yeah, and another thing, listeners, is we have a whole stack of cards. I'll give you the sound effect. That's my bag of business cards from the SHOT Show of potential guests that we're coming up on. But as of this moment, none of them are committed to doing the show, at least on a specific schedule. So there's that as well. So today is a little bit, I wouldn't call it a restart. Maybe it's a reboot of the show. And we're just going to talk between Ken and I, no guests today, about various things. And I think we're going to kick off with a discussion about the SHOT Show, which I went to, and the NRA show recently in Dallas that Ken went to.
Yep.
So, Ken, tell listeners about, if they haven't been to NRA before, why would they want to go to NRA? Why is that a good idea?
Well, this particular year, there was a lot of people there for the fact that Trump showed up. Trump was at NRA today, in Dallas a few weeks ago, and there were a lot of people who showed up to see him. So, but even if Trump were not there, it's a tremendous opportunity to go see the manufacturers. Virtually all of the major manufacturers are there, and you're able to talk to them, and they have pretty much samples of all of their new firearms, and you can go through it, hold them, talk to the salespeople, the developers, you know, even some of the machinists in some of the places. It's a miniature version of the SHOT Show.
Well, how miniature is it? I mean, you know, because we had talked about, if you don't know, listeners, SHOT Show is an industry show. It's not a public show, so you have to be credentialed to get in,
right.
And it tends to be a grind. It cannot be seen in one day.
No, it is a massive show.
Yeah.
SHOT Show in Las Vegas, Nevada is in January every year, and it is a massive show. You will walk until your feet hurt for several days.
I set a record this year. I did, at least to the extent that my iPhone is able to accurately replicate how far you walk, and I've never checked that accuracy. It says I cleared 25 miles.
I wouldn't doubt
this year,
that.
25 miles.
Which is astounding.
In 2.5 days. So, yeah, it's a you better have good shoes. And I skip lunch. I show up when they open, and I leave when they kick me out.
Yeah.
And it took 2.5 days to do it.
Yeah, everybody is at SHOT, and it's an amazing show. And you can go to just particular areas.
Mm-hmm.
And spend time in particular areas of the show. The fun thing about SHOT as well is, I know we are about frugal firearms, but sometimes it can be really fun to go see $500,000 shotgun set. You know,
yeah.
Perazzi is there, for example, and they have some, it's artwork. Yes, it's a firearm or multiple firearms, but the engraver who engraved those shotguns probably took a year to 2 years to engrave one shotgun by hand.
The other thing that it does, too, I mean, again, and tell me to the extent that NRA facilitates this or does not, that at the SHOT Show, since basically everyone's there. Everyone. All the manufacturers are there. You're able to walk from booth A to booth B and compare. Like, you know, this thing that has a $1,700 price tag versus the $700 price tag item. And which one do you like better? And does it make sense? I mean, you can't shoot, obviously, at the show. So you don't get that part of it. But even for accessories and things like that, it allows direct comparisons. Now, does NRA do the same thing for you?
NRA does the same thing. One thing more about SHOT, there is a, for certain particularly a small number of people, I think you have to be in a print publication or something like that, they actually do have a shooting day.
Media day.
Yeah.
Media day.
If you're in the media, like you're on TV or something like that, they'll actually take you out to live fire. They have live fire machine guns, live fire trap shooting, live fire, all the new guns. And for media, if you happen to be have the credentials for that, it's even more phenomenal. And if you don't, kind of Google around on the YouTube or whatever and look for SHOT Show Media Day and take a look at some of the really fun things that they get to see and do.
Well, don't they have something like that at the NRA show in terms of, I mean, is there a media day or a range day or something like that? I mean,
to be honest with you, I didn't look into
it that much.
Well,
it's in Dallas. It's in the city. So
it's in Dallas and city.
Probably at the Dallas Pistol Club.
I didn't look into it, frankly. Okay. When I went, I drove. To get there, it took me 2 days to get there to drive.
This is dedication, listeners, because he drove from Southern California to Dallas.
Yeah, it's about 1,300 miles.
I would have flown just for the record. Yeah.
I drove.
Yeah.
I like to drive. It's a lot of fun.
I like to fly.
Mm-hmm. There you go. The fun thing about driving in Texas is the price of gas was $2.73 a gallon.
That is.
Which is a good $2 a gallon cheaper than it is in Southern California.
Yeah.
Easily $2 a gallon.
Would you have, if you were carrying anything there, would you have been reluctant to fly just because of that? I mean, have you ever checked guns on a plane? I have.
I have traveled with them. It's a little bit, it's always a little dicey when you travel with a firearm on airfare because you don't totally trust that your bag, even as well marked as it may be, with an air tag inside it, is, and do not travel without putting an air tag inside of your.
Absolutely right.
Your case because you want to know. They do lose things all the time.
Or steal it. But I went to TACCON this year, and TACCON was at the Dallas Pistol Club, and I did have to bring guns because it is training. The way they do it is they take your gun, from you. They walk, at least this is in San Diego, they walk you down to where TSA inspects baggage, not individual carry-on, but where they inspect baggage, but they don't let you in. And they've given you what they refer to as a peppermint tag, which is green and white striped. And then they go in, look at, and they come back and tell you, you're good to go, you're not good to go. And they came back and said, good to go. On the other end, in Dallas, the gun does not go to the regular carousel. It goes to the special handling, like for oversized luggage.
Mm.
And then it comes out, and there's a little blue light that flashes, just like a police car, basically, above. And when they bring the thing out, then they know that they have a secure package. And then they check your ID against the package, and as long as they match, you're good. And honestly, I thought, God, this is going to suck, and it didn't suck at all, and I kind of appreciated, actually, the extra layer of security.
Yeah.
Checking the gun in at Dallas, could come back to San Diego, I thought they were going to do the same thing. They're like, nah, we see so many handguns, it's like
Texas.
It's like regular stuff.
Oh, I know, yeah, you leave California.
Nobody cared.
Exactly.
I mean, I still had to check it, but as far as any go wait for it outside the TSA desk, they're like, nah, you're good.
Right.
Okay.
It's a totally different vibe in different parts of the country and how people perceive firearms.
It is. So the NRA show then was public for everybody or only for members?
No, you had to be a member. I think you could join if you wanted to. It was free for members. Now, I'm more than a life member. I mean, I've been a life member for...
Are you endowment? I'm endowment.
I'm endowment member,
We're both endowment.
Yeah, so the nice thing about that was, I've been a life member for probably, almost 40 years? Not quite, maybe.
I don't remember.
Yeah, so 35, 40 years. Probably 40 years. Anyway, and you continue to give money. Hell, I have payroll deduction. Still going off to certain shooting sports at NRA. And
so what would you say? I'm going to interrupt you again. But what would you say to people who think that really Firearms Policy Coalition or GOA
sure.
or something like that is a better organization, and they, a lot of people have a problem with the NRA either because of Wayne LaPierre or just in general, and they think
yes.
that NRA isn't really, doesn't really have our back, or... What would you say about that?
I would sadly have to agree with him. Wayne LaPierre is leaving or has left. And I have known, met Wayne. I mean, we both met Wayne.
Yeah, we did. Up in Orange County.
Yeah, right. And had an opportunity to talk to him. It is his time to go. If not, he should have already left. NRA has not been at the front lines of really defending the firearm sports as much as they should be. Definitely Second Amendment Foundation, much better. Firearms Policy Coalition, much better. Here in San Diego County, San Diego Gun Owners, much better. California Rifle and Pistol Association. There are Second Amendment Foundation. There are a whole host of ones there. Those are the organizations who are stepping up to take the legal fight to the court system, particularly after Heller 2008 decision, and of course the 2022 New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin,
and get those things
done. And if you want to know more about that, there are some excellent YouTube people to take a look at. And do you think I can mention a couple of them right
now?
Sure,
go ahead. I mean, definitely. We endorse all kinds of different things.
Absolutely.
Here,
so. The two I would recommend, actually, I'll give you three that I would recommend listening to. I listen to them pretty much every single day. That's The Armed Scholar. He's out of San Bernardino, California. He focuses, obviously, on California, but he does the whole country. Talk about all the legal things going on in the whole country. And he's a lawyer himself, and he gives you a pretty good understanding of what's happening. Then there's one out of Washington State, which is the Washington Gun... It's William Kirk of the Washington Gun... Darn it, I can't remember. William Kirk, Washington.
Well, people can find it based on looking up the name.
I think it's Washington Gun Law is what it is. But if you want to really understand the Supreme Court, if you really want to understand how the legal system works and how the justices are going to vote on why they do certain things, there is no one better than the Four Boxes Diner with Mark W. Smith, who is a United States, he's an attorney, a member of the United States a Supreme Court bar. He is a best-selling author. He's written about five or six books. The most recent one I just finished called Israel Disarmed.
I've heard of that book. I didn't know the name of the author, though.
Yeah, Mark W. Smith. He is phenomenal. Now, he is going to explain to you the law. So you are literally, and he'll tell you this, you will be the smartest person in the room. You'll be smarter than a legal professor who thinks they know, oh, well, you can't do that. Yeah, you can. Or he'll explain to you why something is the way it is. What's the historical behind it? He is the guy who, if you really, really want to understand the law and have an appreciation for the law and the brilliance of our founding fathers in writing the Constitution and particularly the Second Amendment and how important that is to us today. Mark W. Smith, The Four Boxes Diner.
Well, is The Four Boxes Diner a gun-centric show?
Absolutely. So all it is 2A.
Okay, so I mean, you mentioned that, okay, so it's not
it's
just
Second
law
Amendment.
In general.
No.
Okay.
It's 100% Second Amendment stuff. Although he will talk about, for example, he will talk about a fishing case that's happening off the coast of Newfoundland right now. Well, why? Because it has to do with a legal precedent that's about to be overturned. And when it does get overturned, how it will impact the Second Amendment.
Sure.
Everything comes back to how it affects the Second Amendment. So he may talk about a different case, a different thing, and he'll tell you why this other case that seems to have nothing to do with the Second Amendment is going to be extremely important to us as legal precedent and will be quoted and cited going forward. So
maybe that's a, I don't know if, you know, having his own podcast, if he wants to appear on other podcasts, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't.
Well,
he might be someone to bring on our pod.
Well, we could, right? we could ask him. He's trying to get to 150,000 subscribers right now.
Okay.
And I highly recommend going to the Four Boxes Diner and taking a look at the things that he's done in the past and things he does literally every day.
That's a number. And this is a video,
podcast. Yeah, you can listen to him. Right. I mean, you can listen to him, so. But you basically, the video is just watching him talk.
Well, sometimes you lose context on video podcasts if you're just trying to listen to them because they're talking about, you know, some item they're holding and everyone has the context of what they can see. And if you're just listening, you can't. Join in, really.
No. I mean, he will, for example, when he reads the Second Amendment decisions or something, like what a court decision will be, he'll put the text of it up on the screen, and then he'll read through it. So you can actually read the text as he's reading it himself and describing it to you, why it's important.
So going back to the NRA show,
yes.
Would you understanding that they're two different animals for two different reasons, was it worth the investment in time and distance and cost and... cost was things like hotels and gas and everything else.
Plus I enjoy driving and I like to see different parts of the country. So I'll give you a quick thing. If you've never driven across the United States, that means from coast to coast, put it on your bucket list because the United States is a massively huge country with massive amounts of open spaces and absolutely beautiful. And I would highly recommend everyone do at least once in their life drive across the country, if not go both ways.
I agree. I mean, maybe we have a difference in opinions on what car you should use for that. That's outside the boundaries of this podcast.
Indeed.
Yeah. In fact, I'm about to drive to Arizona, and I'll probably have a much more comfortable time than you would have. But yeah, anyway, that's a separate topic. So they move around the NRA show. Right?
They do. It's been
freedom-loving states.
Yeah. We've been, I think it's been in Reno, Nevada. It's been in Houston, Texas.
Been in Florida, I think.
Been in Florida. I think it was in Atlanta.
It's been Atlanta. Yeah. Right. And I've never, we went to one back in the 80s once.
Yeah, we went.
I don't remember where it was, but it was a long damn time
ago. A long time ago.
Where NRA is, I'm sorry, SHOT Show is more reliably a Vegas thing.
Plus, it's only 5.5 hours away from us.
Or less. You could do it in less. Come on now. I mean, okay. 5.5 hours if you stop or run into traffic.
Or drive the speed limit. Yeah.
No one, including the police, drives the speed limit. I was following a CHP the other day I was having trouble keeping up with him at 80. And he was not running lights and sirens. He was just cruising with traffic, and he was north of 80.
And I will tell you this. I drove 7,000 miles from Southern California to New England and back again in the last 5 weeks. And I can tell you this. I saw maybe two police cars in 7,000 miles on the side of the road with radar.
With radar. You don't mean totally.
No.
We were actually setting traps.
Yeah, who are actually setting traps. And, maybe two.
And that was not in California. Yeah, right. Yeah, California's got a different reputation for that. I mean, it doesn't mean that they don't ever enforce the law, but it seems to be selective and infrequent kind of thing. So, okay, so that kind of brings up topic number two, which was both of these shows are good for comparing things.
Absolutely.
Right? So we have a comparison of two things that are sitting right on the table in front of us. And as an audio-only podcast, of course, dear listeners, you cannot see it, but we'll describe it. One being...
Both of them are 1911s.
Both of them are 1911s. One is a California-compliant Rock Island, and it's a relatively new purchase. Looking at SHOT Show and all the things that I could find... In terms of value, I thought that it was the best overall value. Came with an MSRP of $799.
Mm-hmm.
Street price was a little bit less than that. Very good trigger. And you could talk all you want about, does it have MIM parts in it?
Metal injection molding.
Yes, metal injection molding. In other words, it's not 100% forged. But then again, you're not paying the price for 100% forged. Now, okay, so we'll talk about that for a second. The engineer in me says, I'd like to have forged, but the engineer in me also says that some parts that are low-stress parts don't really need to be forged. So now, which parts are MIM and which parts are forged, I actually don't know. so I can't say whether they got the recipe right in this gun. Mm-hmm. But the slide is nice and tight on the rails. Everything is quite crisp. The trigger is particularly good. And what are we comparing that to? My oldest son's newly acquired Springfield Armory TRP. So what are your observations on the TRP, Ken?
Well, even before we get to that, I might want to just comment on the fact that you have the MIM parts, okay, which are less expensive to produce.
Yeah.
Inside a firearm, and pretty much any firearm, look at the Glock. We have polymer handguns everywhere. They're obviously not metal. And they're obviously, polymer is obviously less strong. But as long as all of the strength exists in the areas that need the strength, the barrel, the bolt, whatever it might be, you're fine. If it's elsewhere on the firearm, if it's on some movable part, the trigger shoe, a button here or there, and it's a metal-injected molded part,
shouldn't be a problem.
It's totally fine.
Yeah, shouldn't be
it's
a
totally
problem.
Fine, because you don't need a forged part for that.
And you know what? To the point, the Smith & Wesson M&P series, they came out with a metal-framed version.
Mm-hmm.
I might be in the minority. I didn't like it. I didn't think it felt right. Yeah. To me, I would dollar. I mean, even for free.
I held it at the show.
I did not think it was a better gun.
No,
I thought
actually,
it was not as good.
Yeah, I actually held it at the show. I know I forgot the model number. The CSP.
I don't remember.
I have to look it up.
But I mean, just ergonomically and just the way the thing felt, it didn't feel right.
Right.
Now, maybe it's because I like Glocks.
True.
And I'm used to the balance on being on top of the gun instead of through the body.
True. I held it and I actually liked it. Okay. And the other thing I liked about it is, I do have polymer guns. You know, and polymer guns have been around since the 80s. The late 80s, the first Glocks, 87 or something like that.
Yeah, the release of the Glock 17 was
87?
About 80, I don't remember, I think it was 86, but something
could
like
be,
that.
Yeah, mid-80s. I guess I look at the Glock and I go, yeah, these are polymer frames and stuff, but will my great grandchild be able to fire that? I don't know. Is a polymer frame going to become more brittle in 100 years? I don't know. Maybe it will.
I had a Glock mag fail, the polymer, you know, with the
failed,
metal
yeah.
Failed because it just split open.
It just split open, right. So part of me kind of likes the all metal guns. I'm not saying, you know, I mean, for carry and stuff like that, I get the ergonomics of and the lightweight stuff of a polymer gun. And I have lots of polymer guns. But you know what? If I want to hand something on to my child, my grandchild, my great-grandchild, my great-great-grandchild, who say, this belonged to, you know, Pepe, whatever, back in, you know.
Hopefully they'll still have rights.
Well, let's hope they do.
I mean,
but an all-metal firearm would, I think, would... It, you know, you can dig this thing, dig one up in an Egyptian tomb 2,000 years, it'll probably be fine. You dig a Glock up 2,000 years from now,
probably
the plastic's going to disintegrate. You know, yeah. I don't know if that'd be the
agreed.
Case, but
agreed.
But that's just kind of me. So I do have a little bit of a.
I'm not buying guns for three generations down the road. I'm buying them.
No, but I'm trying to think about
me. And
well,
maybe one generation down the road.
Oh yeah, one generation. But I want to make sure I hand on. The freedom that I've been given when I was born, that I hand that on in full, in its totality to the next generation.
Well, totality for you is a lot. But
the rights that we have received.
The rights that we received. Okay, so let's compare and contrast. So the TRP comes in at almost $1,000 more
than
the Rock Island.
Right, these are both 1911 pattern firearms.
That's right.
And they are both excellent ergonomically. I mean, the 1911 being now 113 years old.
I don't know the number, but I mean, just like I don't know when the Glock was first introduced. I certainly don't know that number.
Yeah, so I think pattern is 100.
John Browning fans will probably yelling at their radios.
It's
right
called
now
the 1911
saying,
because it came
know
out.
This.
Yeah,
yeah,
it came out in 1911.
But the design obviously predates that.
Yeah, yeah. No, he had a 1903 and even earlier designs that were similar to it. But I mean, basically, this pattern has been out for. Well over 100 years, and there's a reason for that. I mean, ergonomically, he amazingly got it right. Really got it
right. So you're saying you don't like the Glock grip angle?
It's interesting.
The 22 degrees versus 18 degrees, which is basically the difference between them.
Right. I can adapt to either one.
Yeah, I don't have a... This could be like analogous to a food that you just don't have the palate to understand the difference between the two and to be able to discern the difference between
right.
two foods. To me, I adjust to both of them equally.
Equally, yeah.
And,
equally well.
And instantly, I don't really have a problem with the 22-degree grip angle on a Glock.
Right.
I mean...
And I have some with radically different grip angles. I mean, I bought a paint sprayer gun one time, and one of the advertisers... I think it was a DeVilbiss or a Sharp or somebody who made it. And one of their things was it has the same grip angle as a 45, 1911 45.
That was a sales point?
That was a sales point.
Wow.
You know, and that grip angle is incredibly popular. Actually, you know, the Ruger 2245, which I happen to have, which is a 22 target pistol with many of the same ergonomics, you know, basically duplicates this 45. This 1911 45 ACP grip angle, and it's super popular, and I can understand why. I mean, it's been around for 100 years, and people love it. I also have other guns which have radically different grip angles, and I'm thinking of some of the high standard Olympic pistols that I have.
Right, a lot of those are very steep angles because
the idea
is that you. By cocking your wrist downward, you lock your hand.
Exactly.
And it actually essentially immobilizes your
right.
wrist.
Yeah.
Which isn't a bad thing.
No, no. And that's for a target pistol particularly. That's what its design is for. But for a combat pistol, which this one is, the 1911 pattern was designed as the combat pistol, the ultimate combat pistol. And it basically stayed with the United States military for about 70 years. Until the 80s when it was replaced with
the
M9.
My opinion.
The Beretta 92.
I'm not a Beretta fan. Sorry, I'm just not. At least that pattern of gun. And now replaced by the SIG.
Right.
When everyone thought it was going to be the Glock and it ended up being the SIG. That was a big surprise.
Yeah.
So tell me about the TRP. What do you think about... Like, I guess if you like having skin, this gun is questionable because the 20 LPI, I believe it's 20 LPI front strap checkering.
Lines per inch checkering is aggressive, to say the least.
That's one way to put it, yeah.
I mean, you could grate cheese on this.
You absolutely
you
could.
You could grate.
Yeah, you could actually file metal, other metal objects.
You
with
probably
that,
could.
Yeah.
Which makes it, to me... what was it, Jerry Michalik? He's an advocate of smooth grip handguns.
At the expense of disrespecting a person who has been around firearms and has a name in firearms that I could never even consider having, I don't really personally agree with that perspective, but I guess there's room for personal preference.
Sure.
These G10 scales on this TRP are uber aggressive. They're like they're VZ grips. If you've ever, you know, listeners, VZ grips make some great grips, but oh my god, some of them are super, super aggressive.
Yeah, to squeeze this super tightly, it is literally painful because those stipples are digging into your hand so much.
Now, is that what would you notice it in a stressful situation?
Absolutely not.
Definitely not.
No, so, you don't. I mean, people think, in a defend your life situation, are you going to, feel the recoil or hear the report of the round?
Neither.
You don't hear either.
Neither.
When your body dumps half a quart of an adrenaline into your blood system, you don't hear it. You don't feel it.
Yep.
You will act the way you have been trained, and
will you even see the front sight? Will you see your sights at all? I mean,
really? Those are interesting questions.
And the troop will, and you know, probably you could talk to John Correa about this and get a better answer, or at least a statistically valid, you know, or empirical answer. But a lot of people don't even see their front sights.
Right. It's almost instinctual.
Yeah, because survival is instinctual.
Sure, and in most survival situations, it's going to be very close range.
Right, and actually at TACCON, that's perhaps maybe a topic for a different show.
Sure.
But at TACCON, one of the classes I took had to do with, you know, kind of how good is good enough in terms of shooting accuracy. Now, it's interesting that there was one class that was... sort of like it's hard to miss, basically, if you think about index shooting and how much you worry about your front sights and so on. Another class, which was related to three-dimensional aspects of shooting, and by that I mean we were shooting at three-dimensional targets and saying, well, what happens if it's 45 degrees to you? What happens if it's 90 degrees to you? Where do you want to place the shot in order to get a quick stop? In that, they talked very extensively about where the critical zones are and the necessity to get the first shots into those critical zones. There's differences of opinion.
Oh, yeah. No, there are definitely differences of opinion. But, I mean, going back to the overall thing about the TRP, this is a very high-quality firearm that has a lot of the features that some of the hand-fitted 1911 models that are going to cost $1,000 or $2,000 more than this. I mean, you can spend on a 1911 pattern pistol, you can spend $4,000.
But it's not as good as, say, well, Blackhawk for one, which is starts at about $3,500 or goes up quickly from there. Or in some other pattern, the Terran Tacticals or things like that that are, I mean, they're not 1911s. The Dan Wesson, which is really a 2011 pattern gun, or some of the other guns like that. But they're also more expensive. I mean, I think that the price point on this, to have a gun that, you know, is kind of a semi-custom gun.
Yeah, or this is a semi-custom gun. You're going to get the ambidextrous safety, left-right safety. You're going to get the dovetail front and rear sights, which is nice. You get this one has built-in Trigicon night sights or the radioactive night sights.
It does have tritium sights
on it. Tritium sights on it,
but as I close the slide on my RIA...
which is the less expensive option.
A lot less expensive option, and I would say that the trigger on the TRP was... actually, for me, a little on the light side. I actually prefer a slightly heavier trigger, so that's just a preference thing. Both were about equally crisp. The safety on the TRP is a little bit better, just in terms of how crisply it engages and disengages. This particular model, the Rock Island, comes with an extended slide release, which I think is mandatory. I don't know. I think that the original slide release on the is actually terrible.
Yeah, in the original 1911.
It just is too far away from your thumb. If you're hitting it with your offhand, that's fine. If you want to hit it with your primary hand, you have to reach around it. It just doesn't make sense to me. And the weight on the TRP is lower. So there could be a combination. Well, that's a 4-inch versus my 5-inch, so that's part of it. But I think it could be maybe a difference in materials as well.
But I will say a couple things about the 1911 that pretty much all of the best ones have. You can buy what's considered a government pattern 1911, which means the ones that came out just like they did in 1911. And one of the things about that is the grip safety on the back. And the original government grip safeties, to me, are absolutely useless. They do function as a safety.
You mean you want the extended...
what's called the extended... beaver tail.
Yes.
Okay. What the extended beaver tail does is it hooks upward around the back of the grip, and it protects the hammer as it comes down. But more importantly than that is, particularly if you have if you're one of the people who are slightly rounder than other people, like perhaps myself, slightly rounder.
Slightly.
I've enjoyed my share of donuts and high caloric intake for far too long. But nonetheless, because of that, my hands, when I wrap around a typical
government... Yeah, the web of your hand.
Government
for those
pattern,
who can't see this.
Yeah, government pattern 1911 with a standard government...
you'd be pinching yourself.
Well, not only pinching myself, I get what's called slide bite, which means when the slide comes back... it will nick the top of the web of my hand between my forefinger and my thumb, and I will be bleeding.
Well, with the TRP, since you're going to be bleeding on the palms of your hand and on the second digit of three of your fingers because of the front checkering, now you can be bleeding more uniformly
Result. Which you don't want to do just because you're shooting a gun. So, in my opinion, any 1911 pattern firearm should come with an extended beaver tail. Now, they can be added. I've added them to mine. You can buy the part, and oftentimes you have to round off the frame on the back itself. I had to grind off the rear of my 1911 Colt to do that, and basically hand fit it in position. I have a Colt Commander, model series 80, I think it is, Series 80. Anyway, but yeah, if you're going to buy a 1911 pattern firearm, I would definitely get a the rounded beaver tail. If for no other reason, then the gun will be fireable by normal-sized people, as well as those people who enjoy their donuts and their high-caloric things, who, whose hands perhaps were a little chubbier than they should be.
Pardon the cough, people. the other thing, though, that I think is neat about that gun is it does have, and I know traditionalists don't care for this a whole heck of a lot. I like a rail on a 1911.
Absolutely.
And my Rock Island does not have a rail.
Correct. So, and by the rail, we're talking about under the barrel.
In front of the trigger
guard. In front of the trigger guard, you have a Picatinny rail, yep, or some sort of a rail. There
three
are
slots.
With three slots, some only have one slot, but there are, like a Glock will only have one slot, and you can.
Anyway. Well, the Glock slot isn't even the same dimension as the slots. Exactly. I mean,
yeah, they have their own. They're Glock. They can do whatever they want. They design their own rather than use a Picatinny. Why use industry standard when you can create your own?
Yes.
Right. So, but
kind of like Apple.
Yeah, kind of like Apple.
And so, by the way, and by the way, listeners, I am an Apple fan, so I'm not criticizing Apple. Just noting something.
I could criticize them, but we have a separate episode for that.
Quite a bit.
But no, going back to the rail underneath the barrel, underneath the slide, I'm definitely, if you're going to buy a new 1911, and you're not just buying it because it's a classic pistol and you want the exact thing that looked like in World War II or World War I, for that matter, I highly recommend buying one of the manufacturers, and there are a host of manufacturers that produce excellent quality pistols, but I would definitely pick one with a rail that comes on the bottom of it.
You bring up a question, too. I mean, I just saw something about the CMP is currently not shipping any 45s because they have a government audit going on, and it's put hold on all their shipments.
CMP is the Civilian Marksmanship Program.
Yes, exactly. So you can purchase what at least used to be government surplus stuff. They used to have M1s.
They still do.
Now, yeah, they do. They have 45s. But there's two aspects to this. Their pricing. It used to be, the idea was the Civilian Marksmanship Program was to encourage marksmanship among civilians. To do so at basically a subsidized cost because the government was getting rid of surplus it didn't need anymore. Their prices now don't make sense to me.
For a lot of things, they don't. I mean, a lot of their classic rifles, for example, you can still get an M1, a rack grade M1. I know this is kind of outside our stuff, but like
rack grade means basically it was run over by at least a tank, if not, you know, an IED hit it or something.
A lot of people have used it. It's been rebuilt a few times. It's functional. It will work. But, a rack-grade rifle, which is pretty much the lowest-grade rifle.
Yeah.
It basically means, it's there. It does function, probably reliably.
I think it would be reliable, but it's
not a showpiece. It's been carried, and what's the phrase? It's been ridden hard and put away wet. You know, that's a horse. That's a horse reference.
Okay, I was going to say this show this is not an explicit show, we're going to be careful here. But
it's been beaten up pretty good because it's been used quite a bit. Anyway, but you can get those for like $700. But at this point in time, you'd probably do better. I mean, a really nice condition M1 Garand will run you north of $1,500. Or something even higher.
But frankly, I mean, specific to the... Well, the M1 is one thing because they're not made anymore. So there's not really a... Well, that's not really true.
I think there is a couple manufacturers.
But they're expensive. I mean,
they are expensive.
And there's not a large market for them.
No.
My point being that the 1911 is so ubiquitous across a number of manufacturers that I'm not really sure that buying a piece from CMP... Unless
it's not worth it.
Just because of the historical reference.
Historical is the reason.
But now there's something else going on, which is when I was at SHOT, I was told by a representative from Tesis, which makes great guns, by the way, but they're Turkish.
Turkish,
that they were going to be the new manufacturer for CMP for, quote-unquote, mil-spec guns. for traditional pattern guns.
In other interesting.
Words, they were going to sell new TSIS guns through CMP because I guess the government is...
They're running out.
Either has run out or is running out of them. But why would I then... I'm losing the bubble on why would I want to go get a CMP gun anymore.
Well, I don't know. We'll have to look at the prices. The other thing is that CMP guns get mailed straight to your house. You don't have to go through a 4473.
I didn't. Are you sure?
Yeah. Well, I haven't bought one in a long time.
In all states?
I think so. Pretty sure, but we'd have to look into that.
I don't know.
You go onto the website and read about civilian marksmanship program and figure out the latest.
So, listeners, this is homework for you. If you're interested in a CMP gun, go take a look at the prices. If you're interested in it, go see how you qualify, and then go see whether or not what Ken just said is correct.
Yeah. I think in a lot of states, they mail it straight to your house, but which is kind of nice. But, you have to check it out. And, again, the reason to have it is to say, hey, I want a rifle that I know was in World War II.
Yeah, but if it's a new TSIS 45, you're getting a nice 45, except it just came off the line in Turkey.
Yeah, which may be fine. Turkish guns, they make some great stuff.
But it has no historical value.
Other than being the same pattern. But it's the same reason to sit there and say, you know, I'd really like a Civil War black powder Brown Bess rifle or Revolutionary War Brown Bess. Okay, an original one is going to cost you a ton of money. Plus, the steel probably wasn't that great back in the day. And you really want to fire it? Maybe not. Because it might blow up in your hands only because it's 150, 200 years old or whatever or more. Mm-hmm. So there are reasons why you want to have modern metallurgy in classical firearms, and I have quite a few of them.
Well, I mean, as an engineer, I agree with this.
Just the strength of it.
On the theory that engineering capability gets better over time, it doesn't always get better. I mean, look at a modern refrigerator versus an old refrigerator, right?
Yeah.
You know, there was a meme that, like, the old refrigerators, you know, I will outlive you. I'll outlive your children. I am time itself. You know, they worked that well, and now the new ones, don't.
And no, they don't. 15 years to get thrown away.
Maybe in terms of metallurgy, perhaps.
Yeah.
It just depends on...
As a reenactor or something like that, you probably don't want to run around with a historical piece that might be quite valuable.
Well, going back to MIM, I mean, there was no MIM.
No.
Back in the day, because the technology to create it didn't exist, and now you have additive manufacturing, of 3D printing, that did not exist until very recently.
Very recently, and that's going to take off tremendously. People are going to be making, they're going to be printing home metal guns or home metal things, designs, which
no
are.
No one would ever really do that because it wouldn't be legal, right?
Yeah, no, according to the Constitution, you have a right to make your own firearms at home. That is being litigated somewhat now.
A bit,
but ultimately it's going to come down to, wait a minute, we have history, tradition on our side. People have been making their own guns in their garages or in their houses for centuries, but well before the founding of the United States.
So anyway, the value proposition, between the two, which one do you take?
I would absolutely...
If you couldn't shop the market and you had this Rock Island versus this Springfield TRP...
While the TRP is a fine firearm, and it is, an absolute luxury item, I would absolutely take the Rock Island Armory and take the $1,000 that I saved and buy a bunch of ammunition, a bunch of training, a bunch of something else, holsters. I mean,
training. I spent less than that difference going to, well, not when you include the flights and the hotel and the car, no. But if you just include the cost of entry, multiple days at TACCON this year cost me less than that difference. But it doesn't mean there's not a place for it. I don't want to criticize the gun.
No, if you have the ability, and if you know, we're talking about, this is frugal firearms, so we want you to have, you know, the best value.
Frugal,
right? I mean, the best value is without a doubt the 1911 pattern from Rock Island Armory. It's a fine firearm, you know. Is it the extra $1,000 worth it to step up to a really much nicer one? I mean, you definitely can, and if you've got the means to do so, if $1,000 doesn't mean much to you, and you can do it,
or maybe the answer is it depends.
Yeah, the answer technically is it depends. If you have the means, I want people to buy expensive things. And I want, I very much want people to buy ridiculously expensive things. The perfect example I give people is the flat panel TV sets. Remember when the flat panel TV sets hit the market? They were $10,000 for a plasma display TV that would burn in probably in 2 or 3 years. But somebody out there paid $10,000 to buy them. And then we had LED and QLED and OLED and all the new technologies that have
now
come.
Now it's a commodity.
It's a commodity item.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go in and buy a phenomenal television for less than $1,000, less than $500.
Right. Yeah, I mean, on sale at Walmart, you can probably get it for $300.
That's right. But you never would have gotten there had somebody not stepped up and spent the $10,000 to buy the flat panel.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
You never would have gotten there. So I want the people to buy the high-end expensive guns because, yes, there are things that they can do and improve and make things better. And ultimately, those are going to filter down to the people who are the mainstream Joes, the working guys, the people who need a reliable, an absolutely bet-your-life reliable handgun, but do not want to spend the extra $1,000 or frankly can't spend that extra $1,000. They need it to feed their family. But they still want a reliable firearm. The Rock Island, absolutely a great idea. Go ahead and buy one of those. Not a problem at all. Or another pistol. I mean, there are other choices for home defense, that type of firearm or carry firearms.
So what's another? So going to the other end of the scale, if you're now you could carry that full frame,
sure,
45. Depending on how you dress, depending on your size,
sure,
depending on whether you're in an environment that's either permissive or less permissive. And by less permissive, I do not mean illegal. That is not what I meant. What I meant is where carrying might put you in a bad light with the people that you regularly need to be around. I mean, if you're not supposed to carry, I'm not going to advocate that you're... But should you have the right to carry? Yes. Am I going to advocate that you do something illegal? No.
No.
I'm not. But even within those two polar opposites, there's a gray area where carrying may or may not put you in a socially acceptable scenario.
Sure.
With other people that you're around. So there's another gun here that we have to review.
Mm-hmm.
Probably something at the other end of the scale. This is a Ruger LCP Max.
Light compact pistol.
Yeah, it's a 380. So... does it have the, quote, stopping power of a 45? And remember that stopping power in handgun context is maybe an overused term. Will it stop the fight? A lot of times it will. Is it comparable to a rifle? It is not. None of them are. But is 380 enough with a well-placed shot to get the job done? Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Is this the right option for people? Well, if you're in that less permissive environment where, yes, you can legally carry, but at the same time, printing or even the appearance or the opportunity for how you dress around the gun is going to be problematic, is this better than carrying nothing? I would stipulate that it is.
Oh, absolutely.
It's wearing a Viridian light. Now, not a laser. When you think of Viridian, most of their products
green are... green lasers.
Yeah, green laser. That's where they got the name, right?
Yep.
But this is a Viridian reactor RTL light. So why would I want the light on the gun? Why is that a good idea? Well, the idea being that if this is largely going to be used in a low light scenario, which mm-hmm. is likely, that this light, when pulled from its specialized holster, turns on automatically.
Right.
There is a power switch. You can change the motor, turn it on or off, but it's actually recessed in a way that makes it kind of difficult to get to. So the basic concept is that pull the gun out, light comes on, put the gun away, light goes off. Very simple, very reliable, uses a magnetic switch on the inside. And what does that do for you? It helps you in low light situations to have positive ID of the target. It allows you to ensure that they are in fact a threat. It allows you to see other peripheral things that you may not otherwise be focused on. Or have the ability to see. And it puts you, I believe, and remember, this is not a legal show. I don't play a lawyer on TV, as Ken is fond of saying. So this is not legal advice, but I believe that it puts you in a better legal position because you can articulate that you had the light on the gun in order to be able to positively identify that the threat is in fact a valid threat and that you needed to take lethal force action against it. I think that this is a great little package for sticking in a pocket or perhaps a specialized holster. Actually, if you put it in your pocket, the Viridian light isn't a good choice because it's meant to be turned on by the holster.
Right.
But since they do make a specialized holster that they do sell with the, when you buy the light, you get the holster that comes with it. They've solved that problem for you, and now you have something that has reasonable, if not maybe a great deal of power, is again better, a lot better than nothing if you're a good shot. And this is, by the way, a close range weapon. Its sight radius is such, its power is such that this is going to be short range anyway, but remember, statistically, that's where most of your engagements are going to be, at very close range. You would certainly be able to hit something with this. And coupled with the light, while that is, you know, certainly not mandatory, gives you the ability to understand the target better. And there's a mode on this Viridian light.
Strobe lights.
A strobe mode that is really, really bright and definitely would change the OODA loop of the person you're engaged with. If you don't know what an OODA loop is, it's something that was actually developed in the context of air combat, but it was observe, orient, decide, act. And much has been written about OODA loops and how criminals use that and what their decision-making process is and victim selection. And I think we talked about this enough with Joe Dermisi when we were talking about the in episode 8, when we were talking about non-lethal use of pepper spray. But if you can get inside the criminal's OODA loop, maybe he decides you're no longer a valid target.
Right.
And the display of this light alone might be enough to annoy someone to the point
absolutely.
Where they react to it, look away, do something else.
Right.
And that might be enough advantage just to escape.
That's right.
And put it away. And
which is always what you want to do if you possibly can.
And then what do you do after that?
You call 911.
Why do you do that?
You should always be the first person to dial 911.
Because who else will call?
The criminal will call 911.
Yeah, the criminal will call 911. And if they do, they own the narrative.
They own the narrative. The cops will come out and they'll say, did you display a firearm?
Man with a gun.
And you'll say, well, yes, that guy over there was threatening me.
And that is now potentially aggravated assault.
Yes.
Which is a felony.
Right. And you always want to be the first guy to call. As soon as something happens, you immediately, at the first opportunity, dial 911.
Yeah, exactly.
And you begin to describe the situation, what happened, so police can come and respond.
Yeah.
So anyway, but let's talk about LCP just itself. I mean, LCP, the light compact pistol, came out, I don't know, 15 or 18 years ago. The original versions that came out, you see them around, you see them in pawn shops and stuff. A lot of them were purchased by police officers for their off-duty weapon.
Maybe an ankle gun?
Or an ankle gun as a secondary or third one. They originally did not have a good reputation. The first ones that came out, the first set of maybe 1,000 or maybe 2,000 pistols that came off the line.
Just to be clear, the LCP, not the LCP-2 nor the LCP Max.
Correct.
So this is really, I mean, it's a derivative of the LCP-2. It's kind of the third generation, really.
This is a third generation of the LCP. The original LCP that came out 15 or 18 years ago, it stands for Light Compact Pistol, but a lot of people had renamed it Light Crappy Pistol. Police officers who had actually purchased it. Anyway, if you see them in the pawn shops or something like that, just be aware of it. You know, be aware of it. An LCP-2, which came out probably 5 or 8 years after the LCP-1s, that did not have the problem. They got a lot better. And the LCP Max, which is the most recent rendition, is the one that we have here. But some of the additional things is it's got a slightly nominally fatter grip because it has now gone from a single stack pistol to a pistol which is technically a staggered stack, a double stack, and you're going to pick up, I think you're going from 6 plus 1 to 9 or 10 plus
it's
one.
It's 10 plus 1. Actually get in states that permit it, you can get a 12-round extended magazine for it,
right?
Which makes it a little less concealable, but then you have a little bit more purchase on the bottom of the gun for your you know third and pinky fingers.
Right.
It does. That was a dry fire, by the way, people. It does make this odd clank when it fires. It is a hammer-fired weapon. You know, technically, it's an internal hammer. The other thing that I'll point out about this is something that another gun that is, belongs to my son. The original combination has two nested recoil springs around the guide rod. The combination of those two springs from the factory is 11 pounds. There's an upgrade that you can get that changes it to 13 pounds by only changing the outer spring.
Hmm.
So this gun is wearing that. And we tried both the 11 and the 13-pound springs and found that there was a surprisingly noticeable, at least to my hand, a surprisingly noticeable difference because the 11-pound spring allows the slide to slap back pretty hard. And you know, you think it's a 380, it shouldn't be a controllability issue, but it does actually, for a tiny little gun that doesn't have a lot of surface area on your hand, hits pretty hard. And then changing it to the 13-pound spring, it's only 2 pounds different, but as a percentage, it's quite a bit more. And I noticed it on the next shot. On the first shot, the 13-pound spring. It was only $10.
Yeah.
To change the spring.
Right.
So, other than that, they make stainless steel guide rods for it.
Sure.
Which I don't necessarily think I need. They make a takedown pin that has a larger head because some people think there's a reliability issue with the head shearing off on the takedown pin. I think that's not likely. But you know, a gun with very minimal modification. I mean, does it have the best trigger? No. It has a very long take up in the trigger stroke, but I don't mind that. The gun has no external safety. Most people are happy with that, but for a pocket gun, arguably maybe you would want a safety. It doesn't have it.
Depends on your holster.
Well,
think your holster should cover the trigger.
If you're using a holster, a lot of people are going to throw this in their pocket and call it good.
Yeah. I would tend not to do that.
And if you it gets entangled with your keys or whatever the heck you have in the same pocket.
You don't want to do that.
Isn't very disciplined if you do that. The only other external control on the thing is the slide release.
Right. Yeah. So. I would not recommend just tossing it in a pocket with keys. And I wouldn't do that with any firearm. And that includes a revolver like an LCR or a small five-shot revolver or any of the Smith & Wesson's. Exactly. No, I think you should, if you're going to have a firearm with effectively all internal safeties, because these guns are built with internal safeties, they all are.
Yes.
But I would protect the trigger assembly. And there are some very minimalist Kydex-based holsters that really just cover the trigger area.
And yeah, then right.
You could almost, I would almost be okay with that. But I would definitely...
Even the type that you would tie like to your belt loop.
To your belt loop.
You pull the whole thing out.
I pull out and it pops out.
It stays behind. Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly, right.
So something like that would be fine. But I would definitely, on any sort of a pocket gun, cover
the
trigger.
You want to keep that covered. Right.
You want to keep that trigger covered because that's... The trigger is what causes this gun to firearm as a firearm to function, and you do not want to ever have an AD, an accidental discharge.
Or otherwise referred to as a negligent discharge.
Correct.
And if you put it into your knee or your lower leg or something like that, you're going to feel pretty negligent.
Oh, yeah. And if you want to see what can happen, there are some YouTube videos out there.
Oh, hell no, I ain't going to see that.
Okay. But there are YouTube videos out there of people who were shooting a 22 semi-auto, and they were using their back pocket holster, and they insert the pistol into their back pocket and fire off
Boom.
A round.
Yep.
Oops. And the round hits them in the calf, and they're like, "Oh, it's only a 22." And the original guy thinks he's no big deal, and you can almost lose a leg.
You could, yeah. Well, you could bleed out too.
Yeah. You do not want to do that. You do not ever want to be shot or get shot. So anyway.
Okay. Well, anyway, so what do we have in upcoming shows? We're going to talk about, at some point, the Sky DVG-1, which is I would call it a budget pistol, but has some interesting safety features and shoots very, very comparably to much more expensive guns. We got a chance to try that. We'll also be recording a show dedicated to ATN and talking about their new X-Sight 5 line, which we now have a sample of. Actually, I own it on hand that we can review. It's an electronic sight, not traditional glass. It's not a thermal sight, but it does quite well at night. And we'll get through the backlog of all these people, like, oh, gee, how many of them are there? I mean, this stack is a couple inches thick. We'll be doing a feature show with ETS. They make some of the best polymer magazines available. And there's a lot coming up. And we apologize again for being so late hosting this show.
Life happens.
Yeah, life happens. But we haven't given up, not by a long shot. And we're probably going to have a lot more time to be recording future shows. So, you know, pass the word, like and subscribe. I will point out something important. We did change our feed to campsite.bio that used to be on Linktree. Linktree apparently doesn't believe in freedom, and they took our links down because they said that we had violated their community standards, even though we don't promulgate anything on this show that is illegal or outside the guaranteed freedoms that we have. Fortunately, the campsite.bio people, they have similar rules, but we're not running afoul of any of that. So the new site to look at is https://campsite.bio/frugalfirearmspodcast. Again, https://campsite.bio/frugalfirearmspodcast. And of course, you can also find us, and we'd prefer that you find us, on your favorite podcast aggregator, whether that be iTunes or any of the other Google or anything else. But like and subscribe, leave comments there. That helps us get the show out there. And remember that we're also available on Gmail, frugalfirearmspodcast@gmail.com. Again, frugalfirearmspodcast@gmail.com. Any concluding remarks, Ken?
No, I think we've had a very nice restart of what we're doing and look forward to talking to you all quite a bit more. So tell your friends about us. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.